The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China with our indispensable daily newsletter, website, and growing range of podcasts and videos. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from quarantine here in the safely sanitized Cynica studio at my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Joining me from his own sequestration on his sprawling Sylvan Idol in Nashville, Tennessee, is a man who once famously said, on this very show, "I recently sold some Bitcoin and bought a drone," an utterance which won him broad acclaim for the most 2018 thing ever said. And for reasons that will be clear enough to you soon, the fact that he bought a drone is very relevant to today's discussion. First, though, Jeremy, greet the people. How are you, man?
Hey, Kaiser. Hey, people. Doing very well. You know, while the world burns, but I can't personally complain about anything.
You've been out flying that drone at all?
Oh, yeah. I fly my drone nearly every day. Yeah.
Did you know that if certain immigration and customs enforcement officers are to be believed, your Chinese-made drone might be sending sensitive data about the civil defense infrastructure of Middle Tennessee out to those communists? How does that make you feel, Jeremy?
You know, I'm kind of okay with them knowing the intimate details of my holler, you know. That's absolutely fine. I welcome them in person to come over and check it out. I don't think it's going to affect the national security of the country. Well, but maybe we'll find out differently today.
We won't. So on to more serious things. Over the last couple of years, since the Trump administration launched what some have called its tech cold war against China, Chinese-made drones have gotten what you might call the Huawei treatment here in the U.S. Putative concerns over national security have prompted some American lawmakers to introduce, in the fall of 2019, a bill that would bar U.S. federal agencies from purchasing drones made in or containing key components from China. And just this month, in March, a draft executive order calling for basically that same ban on Chinese-made drones was leaked to Politico. Pressure from Congress and from the administration has resulted already in the grounding of all drone flights by agencies like the Department of the Interior, which uses drones for a huge range of important tasks.
Here to talk about this is Brendan Shulman, Vice President of Public Policy and Legal Affairs for DJI, which is the manufacturer of my drone and also the world's biggest consumer drone manufacturer. Previously, Brendan was head of the unmanned aircraft systems practice at the law firm of Cramer Levine in New York, and he is also a member of the Federal Aviation Administration's Drone Advisory Committee. And thank you, the Federal Aviation Administration, for giving me a drone pilot's license.
All right.
Brendan Shulman, welcome to Cynica.
It's great to join you. Thank you.
Brendan, let's start with some of the basics about the company you work for, DJI. So as I understand it, it all started with a remote control helicopter enthusiast named Frank Wong in his dorm room at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. Is that right? Can you tell us a bit about the history of the company?
Yes. In fact, drone technology, at least the technology we're referring to today, really has its origins relating to model aircraft and hobbyist types of remote control airplanes and helicopters. And like me, when I was younger, our company's founder, Frank, was an enthusiast in model aircraft and helicopters, but he had a different take on it. He realized that if we could make model aircraft easy to fly and if we could stabilize them dynamically as well as stabilize a camera attached to them, we could create an amazing cinematic tool and also a tool that would be useful in countless other kinds of missions. And so he founded the company right out of his dorm room in Hong Kong, very similar in many ways to the stories you hear about tech companies being founded in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, so DJI is actually a private company. Where did it raise its funding, and is the company now considering a listing? And give us an idea of how big it is.
Well, at this point, we've got, I think the last count was 14,000 employees globally. Very much a global company, headquartered in Shenzhen, which is, as you would probably know, is the tech center of many consumer electronics companies.
Indeed.
Yeah, it's over the years, when I joined in 2015. The company had, around that time, completed a significant financing from American venture capital firms in Silicon Valley. You know, we're talking about Kleiner Perkins, Accel Partners, those kinds of name brand American investors.
Yeah, the big marquee VCs, yeah.
That's right. And, you know, given the success of the company during what you might call the boom times for consumer drones, including the period at which I think you got your own, we've been able to put the proceeds of the sales right back into R&D, help grow the company, design new products, including for the enterprise and commercial markets, and really just build on our own success over the years.
Brendan, what is DJI's market share in consumer drones right now, and where are its major markets? Because we're talking about a problem in the United States right now, what percentage of DJI's revenues come from the United States?
So we don't have our own estimate of market share, and it really depends on how you define the market. Are you including small little toys that you buy at the drugstore? Are you including sort of large, 2,000-pound aircraft that you might find in more of an industrial application? But I think most observers of the commercial drone market would tell you that we're around 70% of the kinds of electric-powered drones that are useful, either for taking artistic photographs or video from the air, or in life-saving, beneficial missions, including firefighting, search and rescue, law enforcement, and many other things.
Wow.
Do you know how much of your U.S. revenues come from procurement by federal agencies?
We don't track our revenue in quite that way. So I don't, sitting here, I don't have a specific figure for you. But I think it's safe to say that, like a lot of other consumer electronics around the world, the United States is the largest market, probably roughly a third or something like that. But that's my personal guess. I don't keep track of our numbers in that way. And then with respect to government sales, it's a fairly new area for us. If you consider where this technology came from and who was adopting it first, it was very much the consumers. And then from there, it grew into commercial and enterprise sales. And I would say of the enterprise sales, a small fraction would relate to government agencies, some of which are federal. So the federal market is actually not that large, because many of those organizations are still learning about the technology. They are putting it to amazing uses, but we're still on the growth curve for those kinds of applications.
But pretty clearly, this is an issue that still, it sticks in your craw. I mean, the idea that you might be banned from this segment, however small, is there a reason for that? Do you think that would maybe just somehow impact your broader consumer sales?
Well, we're driven very much by what is of concern and interest from the consumers, from our customers. We've learned a lot from them over the years in terms of the features that are important to them. And this is just one of those features. You know, we certainly want the most sophisticated and beneficial uses of our products to be used with confidence by the most sophisticated organizations in the world. They're doing beneficial things. That's our mission, to really have the innovation out there in the hands of people who can save lives, protect property, and realize new kinds of efficiency, as well as make their own jobs safer,
right?
For example, in a dangerous mission. So for us, it's not at all a question of how big is one market or another. It's more about the intellectual desire to satisfy the customer who is asking us to do something that's interesting and new, but also really important to putting the technology into the hands of people who can use it best.
So Huawei, as you know, has been in all sorts of hot water with the U.S. government. It claims to be a private company. Some people believe that's true. The company has always basically been dogged by suspicions of its close ties with the Chinese Communist Party, or specifically with the People's Liberation Army. Does DJI, just for the record, do you have substantial contracts with Chinese law enforcement, with the Chinese military, with any other Chinese governmental agencies?
We're a consumer electronics company, so you know our products are available off the shelf. So the kinds of agencies right. you've mentioned could, and probably do, purchase those products from any number of sales channels. But in my 5 years at the company, I haven't seen any signs of influence or sort of unwarranted connections between what we do in terms of the products we make, the functionality they have, the policy outcomes that we advocate for. I've spent 5 years advocating for reasonable risk-based regulation for drones of all kinds, including our own. And all of that has been in furtherance of our mission as the leading company in the industry of enabling the customers to do great things.
But how to put it? It doesn't really matter whether Huawei is a private company or not, because just like Tencent and Alibaba, if the Communist Party goes to Huawei and says, "Give us data on individual X," they have no choice. They have to give the government data on individual X. I think that really is the crux of the issue. So, what protection do Americans have against that?
With respect to drone operations, a lot of protection, and that's because of both the nature of the drone technology itself, as well as the various safeguards we've built in. And by the way, like any tech company, we obviously comply with the laws in each jurisdiction in which we operate. So in the event of, let's say, an accident involving a drone, which has happened in the United States, we would comply, as we are bound to, with a subpoena for information. In fact, we've been of assistance to the National Transportation Safety Board in a number of collisions and incidents between drones and aircraft in the United States. So there are very good legitimate reasons to cooperate with the laws in each jurisdiction. Now, that said, we certainly have done a lot to assure our customers that drones are safe from either inappropriate or unwarranted access to their data. And it really starts with what the functionality of a drone is. The drone is a camera. Now, it happens to fly, which means that you aren't holding it in your hand. You can position it in three-dimensional space. That's what makes it so great. You know, you can take an aerial photograph of your backyard barbecue and post it to social media rather than just taking a handheld photograph from 6 feet off the ground. And that's an amazingly artistic and creative use of a camera. But you decide where you're pointing that camera. So if there's something sensitive that you do, you can just choose not to use the drone or not to use it in a way that might compromise security. Now, once you do take a picture or video with the drone, none of that image content is automatically being collected by us or coming back to our systems, because we have no business interest in the data. We sell the hardware. So unlike other tech companies you might think of, where the data itself is the product and information about the users is the product, or at least is the source of revenue, our source of revenue is the hardware sale that ends once you buy the drone. So what you do with the drone doesn't really matter to anything that we do as a business. Now, you can choose if you want to back up your flight records, because you might want to save a copy of it for data protection purposes. Mm-hmm. You might want to share your photos or videos on social media if you're that kind of person, but that's entirely your choice. And over the years, we've implemented features that enhance that choice. One example is what we call local data mode. So just like the airplane mode on your phone that turns off the connectivity between your mobile phone and the internet, we have in our software local data mode, which also turns off transmissions of things like software updates and FAA temporary flight restrictions, things you might want to know when you're flying your drone, but you don't need. That provides an added layer of assurance. And then we went on from there to do other things that I'll leave it to you, whether you want to get into things we've done for government users specifically in what we call the government edition version of our products.
I think a lot of listeners will hear the word drone and think somehow of military UAVs, of these unmanned aerial vehicles, as in drone strikes of this sort that are still happening in parts of the Middle East and Western Asia and Pakistan and so forth. But what DJI makes are, they're called drones, but do they have any relation to the kinds of drones used by national militaries?
So our products are very much an evolution of model airplane and model helicopter technology. Basically, if you've ever seen someone flying a radio control model airplane in a park or at a club field, this is a sort of enhanced version of that, in which the drone is more like a helicopter. It can hover. It's very easy to use. It's self-stabilizing. And it contains or carries a camera that can be used to take pictures of or to provide a live video stream from the air, which is very useful, for example, in a search and rescue type of mission where someone is out there. And in fact, we have dozens, if not hundreds of stories of people using these kinds of drones to find missing people, people in avalanches, floods, fires, confused people after a car accident who go wandering off into the freezing night. It's really powerful, but it's actually simple, and it is not a version of the military systems that were specifically developed to carry arms or to fly thousands and thousands of miles away in order to conduct a military operation. These are piloted within visual line of sight, typically a few hundred feet away, to take a picture, for example, of damage to a roof after a storm.
Brendan, a couple of years ago, Clay Shirky, who perhaps we could call a technology guru if the phrase isn't too offensive, was on our show talking about how the whole supply chain for all sorts of advanced consumer electronics has basically moved to the Pearl River Delta, and especially Shenzhen. I believe he used the example of drones, how there are basically whole floors of buildings where everyone is selling components for drones. Can you give us a sense of what it's like in there in Shenzhen, what that vertically integrated ecosystem really looks like, and the advantage that this confers on Chinese drone, China-based drone makers, of which DJI is, of course, the most prominent?
I've been there about 20 times, maybe a little more at this point, and it's always amazing to see the energy. I think the you know, right from the people who are designing the next drone, and just to see them come up with an idea and then literally like run out, get the components they need, put it together, test it, sometimes like right in the lot, right across the street, and then run back up, make some adjustments, go back and do it all over again. So the cycle of innovation is just faster because you can order up the components you want to test them, and then go back and do your next development cycle within hours or at least days.
Wow.
And I think that's really, you know, DJI is unique, I think, in that we've got it's the whole end-to-end, right? The design of the drone, especially, you know, the ones that Frank has worked on directly over the years, all the way down to refining it, making it better, deciding what kind of plastic to use, you know, things that would seem very basic, can be decided in near real time. And to have one product line, like a drone, where you're doing that end-to-end development, production, manufacturing, and shipment within one company, I think is surely an advantage. I mean, I'm not a supply chain specialist, but I can see just from my visits there how quickly they're able to innovate the next generation of features.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's spectacular. It's really quite mind blowing. Let's shift topics here and talk a little bit about your present woes with the U.S. government and how that all started. I believe when we were talking earlier, you said it was really all from one internal memo at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement's L.A. office. Is that correct?
Well, there's a few ways to think about the beginning of the story, but I suppose one of the moments in which a lot of things crystallized was an apparent memo written by someone at the Los Angeles Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. This was not, from our understanding, this was not sent through Washington. It was not actually released or approved or official. It was a draft. and yet it leaked. And it made a number of allegations specifically about our technology that, just from a first reading, were absolutely preposterous. Things like the drone actually is still operating when the battery power is turned off. It's connected to satellite receivers. It's doing facial recognition. Things like our sales efforts have focused on infrastructure organizations. I know that's not true because I see how we do sales. And if anything, we've neglected and have been slow to try to roll out products to key markets like that I think would benefit from drones. So just you read this document that's anonymous, essentially, and sourced to an unnamed industry source who might even be a competitor for all we know because they're not named. And it's absurd. Now, that said, how do you prove a negative, right? What do you do when you have the letterhead of an agency, even though it's not released, on a document that says such absurd things? And we did what we could. Obviously, we immediately said this is wrong, it's untrue, but that wasn't enough. We commissioned a consulting firm called Kivu to actually examine the technology and give us their analysis on these allegations, and they walked through the report and said these things are false. They're not true. So we had the independent evaluation. This was now a couple years ago, but a lot of things have built on that, and it's so amazing. Like maybe amazing is the wrong word. Depressing, if anything, that every time I go to a meeting, even as far away as like the UK House of Commons, where I was asked to testify about safety features, that they make reference to this ridiculous memo as if it's true, as if it's the product of government research and thought and science, which it's not, and which we disproved. And yet it lives on as a mythical thing.
What do you imagine prompted it? I mean, without speculation about a competitor planting this or anything, is there anything that they might have actually seen, anything that might have maybe misdirected them? Was there any data being transmitted in a way that they might have taken for somehow nefarious? I just seems strange that they would have invented this out of whole cloth.
Well, I can't speak for them, but I do think there's a natural explanation to all this, which is as part of the story I've told you already, which is that the products were created for consumer use. That was the focus of our attention for years. And over time, particularly with the release of the FAA's Part 107, now about 3 years ago.
What was that? I'm sorry, can you explain what that was?
Yes, the FAA's Part 107, those are the rules for commercial operation. Prior to 2016, it was not lawful to use a drone for a commercial purpose, according to the FAA.
I see.
Because the FAA lacked the licensing and rules required to operate a drone, an unmanned aircraft system, as it's called, for a business purpose. So the FAA, after years of delay, finally released its rules for commercial operation in 2016. And so since that time, there's now been commercial adoption of these technologies, which for decades have been used for recreation and fun. Including by our founder and including by myself. That's actually my lifelong hobby, has been model airplanes and sort of how I got into all this. Yeah, that's why I'm at the company, because I had an interest in both the legal aspects here as well as the technology. So we started off with products that were 100% consumer by law. You could not have a commercial market. Then once the commercial market started in 2016, middle of 2016, you had, you know, a few early adopters in the commercial world. And then I would say within a couple years or maybe a year or so, you had not only businesses buying them, but you had people in the field, in the military, who were purchasing the products off the shelf with their own credit card and taking them into the operations. Why? I guess, I don't know, but I guess it's pretty useful to be able to see over the next hill if you're... if you've got an enemy out there and you want to survive or complete your mission. So, you know, these became just useful tools because of how well they worked, even though they weren't designed for military use or to meet military specifications. And then I think what happened is as DJI became more successful and alternatives in the market basically disappeared. There were a number of U.S. and European companies that really faded from the market over the past couple of years. The military, I think, became uncomfortable that if they wanted a small quadcopter, a small electrically powered camera drone, the only choice in terms of a capable product would be a Chinese product, whether it was ours or some of our Chinese competitors like Unique or Autel or Ehang. Like basically all of the companies in the market with capable products were based in China. And I understandably, that's uncomfortable and probably something the military is going to want to do something about. But we think the pressure really has come from there. And it's understandable, both from a political point of view, as well as a security point of view, that off-the-shelf products, particularly foreign ones, are not going to be comfortably usable by the military. Right. And that's why we've seen the creation of a trusted capital marketplace. It's also why the very early memos, even before that Immigration and Customs Enforcement memo, were Army and Navy memos that actually, when you read them closely, they mention DJI because we're the leading brand. But what they really say is that any off-the-shelf drone, flying camera, is going to pose some security risk and therefore shouldn't be used without validation or mitigation steps to guard against data leakage. And we agree with that. But again,
Not an unreasonable position.
No. And so I think look, this is a long answer to your question, but I think it's an important one, is that this is not surprising that a product developed for consumer use and then adopted for commercial and governmental use would raise data security questions, particularly when used by agencies that are understandably sensitive about using foreign technologies.
So in some ways, it's a reprise of a theme we've become a little too familiar with over the last few years, where people in the United States are blaming China for the fact that here in the US, we don't make stuff anymore. Because in fact, there are no American competitors that make anything even close to the quality of DJI. And I'm sorry to have to say this to you. I'd love to be able to take you down as a person acting as a spokesperson for DJI, and I'm a journalist, but it's just a fact that there are no good American consumer drones.
Well, look, there were at least a couple companies that I think actually had very credible opportunities to be successful, namely 3D Robotics and GoPro. GoPro, being a public company, had access to its own very impressive camera technology, as well as the resources of a public company. But I think it was a late start, and so what they put on the market was large and heavy, and really felt like it was a generation or two behind, as it was, because of the late start. Part of the story here is that we were simply first to create these amazingly capable off-the-shelf drone products, and that's actually a fairly complicated thing to create. You have to get motors that are spinning. You have to stabilize the camera from the shakes of those motors. You need to create a flight system where the drone doesn't just fly away. So you need GPS integration. And you need a video, a wireless radio video downlink, so that the person flying the drone can see in real time what they're framing for their shot. Putting all those things together is really each step builds on itself. And if you just come at it and say, okay, I'm going to start from nothing and build a drone today, you can make something fly. Absolutely. It's not hard to build a drone, but I think it's hard to integrate all those things in an elegant and powerful way, as we've been doing for 13 years.
Absolutely. I mean, my feeling as a customer on getting my drone was equivalent to somebody getting their first smartphone. It was just like, wow, this is magic. And obviously the magic took quite a lot to put together. But to go back to the political question, so we had this sketchy memo from a customs official But then things escalated to the legislative branch here in the United States. Who carried the banner on this? Were there particular senators behind this, or you know, where was the momentum behind the anti-DJI movement?
Well, I there've been a number of bills in Congress. I think it's fair to say they've come from members of Congress who tend to take a critical view of China more generally, not just on drones. This is not, I mean, if you look at the American Security Drone Act, for example, by Senator Rick Scott of Florida, it could be about any technology, right? The focus is China and perceived threats that relate to political issues, not anything about the technology itself. You know, if you've traced that bill through its evolution so far, you'll see that there is an effort to identify certain components of the drone that should not be Chinese. Then the issue is, well, maybe it's the company that's creating it. Well, I mean, when you step back and think about what these things are about, they're not about, the proposals are not about security, because if they are about security, it would inevitably lead you to sort of two different places. Number one, why just drones? There's nothing special about drones. They're cameras that fly. And if you're concerned about a Chinese component, you should be concerned about a Chinese component in a smartphone, a radio, a television, a microwave, your fridge, your car. And guess what?
Don't give them any ideas.
So my iPhone is as dangerous as my DJI drone, is what you're
more,
saying.
More, probably.
Well, I would say more. Well, in terms of risk profile, your smartphone is there in the middle of all of your, well, not all, but many of your conversations, whether they're data transactions or voice communications or something else, or just, you know, physically tracking your location, right? So the phone exposes a lot of different types of data that I think Americans consider to be private and a security risk. And that's also true for the telecommunications equipment that may be relevant to other Chinese companies. But what is the drone? The drone is not that. It's not a communications tool. It's a camera. And you remotely control it. You press the button to take pictures if you want to, and there's no need to connect it to anything. So your phone doesn't work unless it's connected, and it's the connection that creates the data loss risk. Your drone, you can fly without ever connecting it to the internet during its operation. Right. And therefore, inherently, the risk profile is different. So when you look at these bills, why stop at just drones would I think be a question. And sort of number two, what about risks that might be presented? If you believe the drone is some kind of special risk because of how it operates, you know, it's an aerial perspective or something like that, well, then you can't just stop it at China. You would need to bring in other drones and say those are a risk too, and that risk has to be mitigated through something like cybersecurity standards that any product should be able to meet. So it actually makes no sense to draw the line at China versus non-China in terms of any particular product, because you aren't solving a problem and you're actually creating a false sense of security.
Right. But there's another piece of
that. And also the whole thing is ridiculous because you can get a very, very detailed map of, for example, my holo where I usually fly my drone. I think you can get as useful a map of it from Google as you can from anything I take. So it seems a very sort of 19th century view of security risk, in the sense that, you know what's over the other hill, and that gives you some kind of advantage. But China's satellite systems already have a much greater capability to spy on my holler than my drone does.
Well, look, that really goes to some of the most recent developments on these issues and perhaps the most troubling. And that is that we spent 15 months with the Department of Interior that came to us saying, look, we're the federal government agency. We have data security requirements. There's nothing out there to tell you how to meet those. We want to work with you because your products are 10 times better or one-tenth the cost of anything else out there. So we want to use them, but we also want them to be secure from our perspective. And we said, okay, that's not a huge market, but it makes sense to solve problems. That's what we do. We want to be innovative. So we worked with them. We created a solution that works for their specifications. As we found out later, they had that validated by NASA, as well as the Idaho National Laboratory working for DHS CISA, and a third-party commercial firm. So this solution we created for them, which we later called Government Edition, was validated as being secure. The data doesn't go back to China. In fact, no data leaves the drone because the point of Government Edition is to cut off the transfer of even the possibility of transfer of pictures and telemetry to anywhere. So we created that for them, and they validated it, and that was announced. And then a few months later, the program was shut down. By the way, what was that program doing, much to the point you were just raising? Those programs were conducting fire prevention and firefighting missions. They're used to count fish. They're used for ecology missions, land stewardship and preservation, environmental missions. So to your point about, you know, looking at your, you know, where you happen to be located, I don't know much about that area, but when you look at what the Department of the Interior was doing with drones, they were basically using them to observe and fight fires in the forest. And that is clearly not a sensitive mission. Nonetheless, they had a secure product that they validated, and yet they were shut down. So I can't think of a better example of sort of proving that this is not about security, because the security issues were satisfied, the mission is not sensitive, and yet the program has been shut down. And by the way, the DOI, the Department of the Interior, has by far the best government drone, civilian drone program out there in the world. They were winning awards and getting widespread praise across the American and international drone communities for putting drones to amazing beneficial uses, protecting the lives of firefighters, protecting property on the ground, and you name it, and training other agencies, including state and local agencies, to do the same. So we've lost, at least for now, really one of the gems of the federal government civilian drone program. And I don't think there's a good reason for that.
That's just tragic. So, I mean, these federal agencies, you said DOI, the Department of the Interior, but also EPA, the USDA, they were all using drones, yeah?
Well, I think to varying degrees. Again, we, you know, since we don't track our customers, we don't know exactly who's using the drones and for what. But we do hear good stories that people want to share with us. And yes, it looks like the U.S. Department of Agriculture was using them. We know that NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Association or agency, was using them for things like whale research and stuff like that. Coast Guard and potentially life-saving missions, I believe.
And just within Interior, you have like USGS, the National Park Service.
Yeah, Fish and Wildlife.
Fish and Wildlife, yeah.
Yes, yes. So again, we're still at the beginning of the drone industry in terms of the use of this technology, but right now is like the time when the agencies are really starting to develop these amazing applications. Probably my favorite from the Department of the Interior is prescribed burns. So you can take the drone and drop these little plastic pellets that actually start the fire using chemicals. And that's a prescribed burn that creates a fire break so that when the fire comes later in the season, it stops. It's the kind of thing that's been done by helicopter for years. Last year, the U.S. Forest Service had a helicopter crash that killed the pilot doing that kind of operation. So now we can do it with a drone. There's no risk to anyone on board. It is a fraction of the cost, and it's efficient as well. And the Department of the Interior was sort of working and had pioneered how to do that with the drone, and that's been shut down. So as this fire season starts to approach, and we all know what happened in Australia over the past year, I'm very concerned that this tool that could more efficiently fight fires and prevent them has been grounded, even though I can't understand what the data sensitivity issue would be for a mission that involves dropping plastic balls in the woods, which, by the way, is the data from that mission is publicly releasable. You can file a FOIA request and get the information about what they were doing. So where's the justification for shutting down that kind of operation as we head towards the fire season?
Yeah.
Brendan, we've all got COVID-19 on our minds, or I assume we all do, unless we are living in caves. So what are some of the ways that drones might be useful to federal agencies in the United States, perhaps FEMA or the FDA or CDC or some other agency right now in the fight against COVID-19?
We're seeing a wide variety of applications, and I would say some of the most popular are things that you can do today under existing rules using existing technology. So, for example, from the aerial perspective, you can see whether there are people gathered in a park or a beach or somewhere where they shouldn't be, and very quickly get a sense of how many people are there without having to send somebody over there to walk through the crowd. That can allow you to respond and try to either enforce or encourage people to go home, which, as we know, is the most important thing for us to be doing right now. There are drones, including a model we sell, that has a loudspeaker that can be attached. So you can actually provide those instructions to disperse remotely by voice. You can tell people, you know, you really need to follow the guidelines and go home. Beyond that, we obviously, drone delivery of supplies is a great application in that you can drop things off without human-to-human contact. And we're also seeing, and this is actually a program that we worked on in China, which, as you know, was first with the pandemic, to spray disinfectant in the cities. And we worked with an agriculture university in China to do that in 1,000 counties across China. And wow. Determined that it was 50 times faster than doing it by hand. So every little thing matters. I think if you can warn people to go home, if you can spray areas that might benefit from a disinfection, that's great. And also, there's all the force multiplying effects of drones to begin with. So as police or federal officials call out sick because they've been exposed and need to isolate themselves, or if they're indeed actually sick, we have fewer people doing the same regular public safety and law enforcement and firefighting missions. And the drone can help those people do their ordinary jobs, not just the pandemic-related jobs, when their colleagues are out sick. So what we're seeing is the drones being called into use as they would have been before the situation, but all the more need for technology tools to help make jobs faster, more efficient, and in many cases, like firefighting, actually safer.
Yeah. So Brendan, what is the situation with legislation right now? And why did the Trump administration feel like it needed to follow up with this executive order or this potential executive order? And I guess maybe can you explain, is there a difference between the proposed legislation as you've seen it and the EO, or are they basically the same thing?
Well, what we've seen is a draft executive order that was reported on by Politico. I can't speak for the administration in terms of why they would want to do that. But I do think it's an example of the many different types of policies that we've seen proposed relating to Chinese drones. Now, the draft EO does a few other things that go beyond the legislative proposals. Number one, federal agencies would not be permitted to purchase or use drones that are covered. And the ones that are covered are not just the ones that are made by a Chinese company or made in China, but in fact, drones that contain a variety of components that are made in China. And when you look at that list and you understand the drone industry, you would realize that I don't think there is a drone product on the market, and certainly not any good ones, that don't contain at least one component made in China that would fall into those categories. So number one, it basically shuts down all the use of drones by federal agencies because of how broad the scope is on which products are covered. Number two, grant recipients or others that are in under contract with the federal government or subject to cooperative agreements would also be restricted from purchasing Chinese drone products. And then number three, and this again is another step forward that is troubling, is there's a provision that would prohibit anyone from operating such a drone over federally managed lands, including lands in which the U.S. government has a leasehold interest.
Jesus.
Yeah. So what we're starting to see is that you know as you're flying the drone that you love out there, if you happen to be flying over something owned or managed or leased by the federal government, you're in violation. And again, doesn't matter how sensitive that location is or not. Doesn't matter who you are, who you aren't. The executive order is drafted would say you can't do that. And to me, that actually has a broader implication. That means that whatever these purported security issues are starting to intrude into what the industry would tell you, I think, is a right to fly, right? We all have a right of transit in the airspace. Drones are aircraft. Under federal law, you've got a right to go out there and fly your airplane or your drone. And, assuming you comply with safety regulations, of course. So what that proposal seems to suggest is that even the right to fly of an ordinary citizen might be in jeopardy because of these policies and the motivations behind them.
So, yeah, I think maybe the only way to get this through is to make a comparison with guns, that if, there is a portion of the metal in your Smith & Wesson that is from China, you're not allowed to use it. Anyway, Brendan, Kaiser, talked about the Huawei treatment and, saying that in some ways this is what's happened to DJI. Do you see strong parallels between the Trump administration's moves against Huawei and what they've done with DJI, or are there some important differences?
Well, I think if there's a common theme, it's that being a successful Chinese company makes you a target because of the political environment we're in.
Right.
And, I don't have a view on sort of the specifics of each company. You know, you could also ask about ZTE, for example. And, everyone's got a different story, and that's fine. But I'm most familiar with DJI's story, and it's pretty amazing. It's Frank's story of bringing this technology to market, perfecting it, making it affordable, easy to use. We've been counting stories in the press on people whose lives have been saved or who've been rescued by drones in the scenarios I've described, namely missing persons, floods, avalanches, disoriented people after a car crash, that kind of thing, missing kids. And we're up to, I think it's now 320 people have been rescued using these battery-powered drones. So, so the benefits are enormous. And certainly any policy should always take into account risks and benefits in any outcome. And it doesn't seem like that's happening. Instead, the identity of the company in terms of where it's headquartered seems to be the principal factor in the policies. And if you're a market leader or at least visibly successful, it seems like that's going to draw attention. And there aren't too many companies out there that I think are... I think another example maybe for your list is TikTok, right? And whose parent company is ByteDance. And I see they're getting a lot of attention because they're the up-and-coming, very popular new social media video app. And again, I'm not sure what's sensitive about people doing social media videos of their hobbies and activities. And yet there's been a significant amount of attention on that company. And I think, again, the pattern is... if you're a successful company in your industry and you're headquartered in China, you're going to get scrutiny, even if there's no substantive issue relating to security.
And even if there's substantial benefits from it.
I think that's true, although I would hesitate to compare DJI to TikTok, because I think the security risks are different in the sense that TikTok is a potential vector of political influence, whereas I don't think my drone is going to feed me misinformation about the American election.
Yeah, I need you to spend some time on TikTok there, Jeremy. Take a look at what's actually going on.
I have. Okay. I really don't think DJI should compare itself to TikTok because like Huawei and ZTE, the worries are well-founded, even if they're not scientifically executed. Whereas the reason why I'm happy to... do this and, you know, talk to Brendan and not treat him like a spin doctor, but like a reasonable person is because I think the risks are very different.
I agree, but I think the trigger for the attention is the success, right? If any of these companies...
That's correct. Yeah, that's right.
And so that's the similarity. I think, as I said before, if you wanted to get into the differences, both in terms of the story of the companies and the nature of their technology, we could talk for another hour. Because you're absolutely right. As I said before, the drone is a camera, and you decide what you take a picture of, and it doesn't need to go anywhere, unlike a social media app whose entire value is the sharing of data and information, and as you point out, in two directions, thereby providing perhaps capabilities that are different in kind. But I agree with you. If you know drone technology, what it does and how it's used, and the ways in which you can actually mitigate the data security risks, just like the Department of the Interior actually did and validated, then you wouldn't be worried about DJI. You would only have a political issue with the success of a Chinese company.
Right, right. Well, more brilliant ideas from the Department of Cutting Off Our Nose to Spite Our Face. Yay, Trump. Brendan, thank you so much for joining us. We've been chatting with Brendan Shulman, VP for Public Policy and Legal Affairs at the Shenzhen-based drone giant DJI. Man, I am going to go buy a drone. This has just been making me itch for this. But I wish you luck, man. Stick around. We're going to do some recommendations.
You're going to need it.
Thank you.
Before we do recommendations, I do want to remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. If you like this podcast and the other fine shows in our network, the way you keep us going is to subscribe to SupChina's Access newsletter. For just $88 a year, you get this excellent newsletter delivered to your inbox. You know, I'm going to do Seneca 10. It's the 10th anniversary of Seneca in April. So use the code Seneca10, get a 25% off. $66 is what all we're asking for a year. You get early ad-free access to this podcast. You get discounted admission to our major conferences and free admission to our live podcast recordings and all sorts of more stuff. So sign up.
I hope you asked our publisher's permission for that discount, Kaiser. But anyway.
I have. It's already going. It's going. It's okay. Going, man. It's a real discount.
I didn't even know about that. Okay.
$66. Yeah. Get it out there, Jeremy. Okay. On to recommendations. Jeremy, start us off.
Yeah, well, $66, that's a good number. I should just mention that I recently checked my social credit score on Weibo, and my social credit score is 666.
Yes! Very nice. All right. Satan approves.
So I'm going to recommend two things from my native land of South Africa. One is a radio station called Fine Music Radio, which you can find on, let me just check the URL. It is j.mp/FMR, as in Fine Music Radio, FMR Stream. And it's a Cape Town-based radio station, plays jazz and classical music. And I'm somewhat biased, or at least I was introduced to it by my university classmate and dear friend Evan Milton, who on Thursdays at 3 p.m. New York time has a show of 2 hours of South African music, which is pretty good. It may be on hiatus for a couple of weeks because they're trying to figure out how to do things when nobody's supposed to go to work because South Africa is also on lockdown. But it's a really good radio station. Similar, a website that covers their mission statement is something about social justice, but they do a great job of reporting on various issues around Africa called newframe.com, newframe.com. And they've also started a COVID-19 music podcast that you can find on their homepage right now, which has some very nice jazz and South African music and reggae. So, yeah, those two things.
Okay, excellent. Good recommendations. Brendan, what do you have for us?
Thank you for the opportunity to make a recommendation. So my wife is a novelist, and so I must recommend her latest novel, which is called Eternal Life. Her name is Dara Horn, H-O-R-N. And it is there's actually an interesting tech angle to it. So this is a book that's about a woman who can never die, literally, hence the title Eternal Life. And if you think about some of the more interesting and amusing stories in the past several years from the tech industry, you have a number of tech entrepreneurs who've been searching for the secrets of immortality, including genetic-type discoveries. So the book really goes through generations of this woman's life and what it means to not die, as well as kind of her relatives who are trying to coincidentally explore technologies that might cause you to have eternal life. And sort of at the end of the story, you sort of think about what does it mean to live forever and what's the value of life. So obviously in these very exceptional times when we're hearing all kinds of horrible things in the news about just how precious life is, I thought this might be a good recommendation.
You know, I'm looking at it right now. It's available on audiobook from Audible, and it gets really good ratings. It's a 4-star rating, 119 reviews of this book. It looks really good.
Oh yeah, she's serious
it right now.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. She's a serious novelist. Well reviewed in the Times and elsewhere.
Oh, fantastic! That's great. I'm a big reader, so and I'm even bigger audiobook fanatic, and it was just in the market for my next listen, so thank you. I'm going to make a couple of coronavirus-related recommendations. One is the recent New Yorker article by Siddhartha Mukherjee, who is an MD as well as a regular contributor to the New Yorker, and he's fantastic. He's looking at how the viral load, the actual amount of virus to which somebody is exposed, may be a big factor in determining health outcomes for people who are infected with the virus. I really love this guy. His writing is just great. I've recommended The Gene Intimate History before on this show. He's actually probably more famous for his book on cancer, Emperor of Maladies, which is also just great. My other recommendation is also from The New Yorker, and it's the interview with Isaac Chotiner. He's the interviewer of this guy, Richard A. Epstein of the Hoover Institution. It's like a master class on how not to behave when being interviewed. While we're at it, I mean, I don't know what you think of the question of that the journalist asked, but there was another master class recently on how not to be interviewed by the senior WHO advisor Bruce Aylward when he was asked about Taiwan during a Skype interview. Whew, boy, that was hard to watch. Did you see that, Jeremy?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, that was just... I mean, it would have been so easy for him to just say, I am not a political advisor, but an epidemiologist for the WHO. And so that question is really kind of beyond my purview, which might have not have been completely honest, but it might have gotten him off the hook. I mean, that was just...
Well, Kaiser, you do have experience doing PR for a company that, has difficult questions to answer. So maybe it would slip a little more easily off your tongue than his.
Oh, man, it slips so easily off my tongue, doesn't it? Brendan, thank you once again. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Jeremy, as always, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, as a China bashery as I have become lately, I really hope that DJI can continue to sell its drones in America, because my current drone is, probably going to wear out in a year or two or three, and I'll need a new one. So good luck, Brendan.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm going to go get one. I got to secure like an online speaking gig first, and then I'll go get one. Thanks,
guys. Sell some Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'll sell some Bitcoin.
The relatively new Mavic Mini is like one of our smallest and most affordable drones, and it's actually pretty capable. It's actually a really good example of what I was talking about, just refining and refining the technology, making it smaller and lighter, is something that comes from a decade of working on the same technology.
Cool. Well, that's on my shopping list then.
Cool.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News, and make sure to check out all the other podcasts in our growing network. Watch this space for announcements of new network shows. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.